Hello and welcome to Rock and Roll Politics, the podcast with me, Steve Richards. Thank you for tuning in wherever you are in the UK and indeed around the rest of the world. And as usual, we've got a heck of a lot to cram in our time together. In a minute, I'll be in a conversation with Will Hutton, the writer, journalist, broadcaster, who's got a great book out, an important book out, called This Time, No Mistakes. So I'll be having a conversation with him. Afterwards, a few of your brilliant questions that have continued to come in over that Easter period. But before all of that, a few notices. First of all, very important, for Patreon subscribers, and thank you for subscribing, and please do, if you haven't, because it helps keep this whole thing on the road with the legendary podmasters and Simon, the producer, and so on. But more immediately, the reason to subscribe is that the next live gathering for those of us on Patreon will be the day after the local elections next month. That's Friday. Is it Friday, May the 4th? Anyway, the day after, the Friday after, at 5 p.m. We will all need to gather to make sense of it all. I'll give some opening reflections, and then we can have a wider discussion. We all know what is at stake. There is, I think, a group of Tory MPs talking seriously about toppling Sunak. If they are bad, will that happen? It won't have happened by the Friday, but we can make a sense of how it is. Or maybe are the polls exaggerating the scale of Labour's supremacy and the Tory decline? It will be a moment of significance and with consequences, and we can gather together for the Patreon subscribers. And if you are on Patreon, sign up to the live event and you're on, and we'll all get together then. This month for Patreon, it will be the latest in our series, Preparing for Power, comparing the new Labour prominent figures with what is happening now. And this month, it will be based around an interview I did with Robin Cook, the then shadow foreign secretary in the build-up to the 97 election. So if you subscribe, you can get all these kind of different things. Anyway, a lot to, I was going to say look forward to, but let's stick to make sense of on Patreon and, of course, here as well. Now, Will Hutton, yeah, he, of course, I mean, talk about the build-up to 97. He wrote a famous book called The State We're in the build-up to 1997, and it looked for a time as if Tony Blair was going to take this almost as his text into power. And that didn't happen quite in the way it looked as if it might, and arguably should have. But Will Hutton's done it again now with the build-up of another likely Labour government. He has written a book that contextualises, our favourite word, to revise that phrase, the state we're in now. Why is so much not functioning in this country? And he goes back a long way. And each reference to the past, highly pertinent and relevant and interesting. And then comes up with a range of proposals that makes you feel optimistic about the possibility of change, even within all the familiar constraints and with the caution of the current Labour leadership. And the book has an urgent title, This Time, No Mistakes. So, here is the conversation with Will Hutton. Will Hutton, we could spend an hour on the title itself, This Time, No Mistakes. Explain, first of all, what you mean by mistakes.
Well, in my view, Britain took a decisively wrong course in 1979. I know Lady Thatcher, Mrs. Thatcher, is lionized by many on the right, but I think she launched Britain on a more acute version of a way of thinking about how to do capitalism that has not worked across the West. The attempt to kind of roll back the state, diminish public investment, all around the notion that actually public agency is burdensome and actually you must set the market free and individuals and individualism is put at the center of the moral, economic and social universe has led to a series of first order and second order grave mistakes. Mistake one, the monetarist experiment of the 1980s. Mistake two, the mania to deregulate the financial system, culminating in the great financial crash. Mistake three, austerity, launched in 2010, again around the same organizing principle. Mistake four, Brexit. And then that being bookended by a kind of, it was only a 49-day mistake, actually, the Liz Truss premiership and the kind of dash for growth by unfunded tax cuts. All of them have led to Britain being in the position it is now, and a bunch of second-order mistakes, again, kind of fueled by the same mania. I mean, examples are kind of legion, but you know, the privatization of the probation service in 2011 and its renationalization some years later is one, but there's, you know, there's a legion to choose from. And this culminated in Britain being in the position it is now. So this time, no mistakes.
And just the, this time, the first part of the very arresting title, is that also many people assume there's going to be a Labour government. So when you say this time, is that a message aimed at the Labour government to come?
Yes, but it's aimed broader at that, because what I think is that although a large number of industrialised economies and societies moved in this direction over the last 40 years, the year of neoliberalism, if you like, it was most acute in the UK. And one of the reasons for that was the weakness of the British liberal left in putting up a kind of a counter-argument. And I simultaneously want a kind of non-conservative government to kind of drive in a different trajectory, which I'll explain in a few minutes.
Yeah.
But that needs to be housed in a much better philosophy. And social democracy got enfeebled. Socialism is no longer a compass. It was never a compass, even 100 years ago, but less so now. And I argue in the book for a fusion of what I call an ethic of socialism and progressive liberalism, in plain English, a floor, a kind of social contract floor, and also a ladder up which people can climb as individuals, as being the kind of answer to the riddle of how you construct a good economy and good society. So that philosophy needs to inform a different direction of travel for a Labour administration. So in that sense, this time, for God's sake, don't do kind of Thatcherism, if you like, but in a nicer way, which was the kind of the core of the New Labour project. Don't keep kind of surrendering ground to a conservative vision of how an economy and society works when it probably doesn't. Have your own philosophy, sell it to the electorate and do it.
And we'll look towards the end about how hopeful you are that this might happen, assuming there is a Labour government. But we need to go on a journey before we get to that point, as your book does. It's interesting, just in passing, you mentioned the New Labour project, and you also mention your passionate belief in the good society. And I noticed in the book you say that actually, in a way, the most enlightened contribution that Tony Blair made was in the rewriting of Clause 4 in that period before the 97 election, where people kind of overlook the words. They just noticed the scrapping of the old Clause 4 as a big moment. But you say those words kind of articulate what you mean by the good society, the new Clause 4, which was interesting because it's not referred to very often.
No, it's not. It's unread. It's largely forgotten, and it's not really referenced. But what it says is that it tries to redefine what socialism is around the kind of the many acting together can deliver more, both for society as a whole and for us as individuals by acting individualistically, but simultaneously recognizes that individuals have responsibility to the society of which they are part, as well as having agency and a desire to kind of improve their lot, to live a life they've reason to value. And I regard that fusion of what Blair at the time, when it was being rewritten, he said it's the ethic of socialism that's most enduring. And I think he was right on that. And he was also right to acknowledge that's not inconsistent with, and it's perfectly compatible with, a measure of individualism. for me, the task of the liberal left is to build on that, which I thought, you know, was a if you like, a great contribution.
It's interesting as well, isn't it, that, I mean, one of our favourite words on this podcast is context. Nothing happens by chance. And your book is both about politics and economics. And the politics is fascinating because you revisit another early Blair theme, actually, of the progressive opportunities that have been lost. This fusion that you seek between democratic or social democracy and a kind of clearly defined form of progressive liberalism could have happened at various points. And you chronicle how at each moment it is lost.
Kind of researching and writing the book was kind of, for me, revelatory, even down to the name of the Labour Party. Because, of course, the Liberal Party was formed in the late 1850s. It was a very young party, and the trade unions were beginning to grow. And in 1874, and the Liberals stood aside in a couple of seats in Scotland, mining constituencies, and said, look, you know, take the Liberal whip, but you must speak for the Labour interest in the House of Commons. And Liblabbery was born, Liblab MPs. And there were Liblab MPs in the House of Commons right up to the First World War. And actually, it was the more successful part of the kind of progressive coalition at that time. So, you know, in the 1890s, there was a group of intellectuals and labor activists and liberal activists and kind of apostles of the new liberalism alongside a kind of a man like Ramsay MacDonald who were kind of debating whether or not the rising trade union interest could be assimilated in the Liberal Party, and there could be one party, like the American Democrats, that in first past the post system would take on the Tory Party, and never got off the ground. But importantly, there was a secret pact in 1903 between Ramsay MacDonald, who was the Secretary of the Labour Representation Committee, and the Liberal Chief Whip, and the Liberals offered Labour a free run in 40 seats, and 28 Labour MPs got back. The Independent Labour Party in Keir Hardie only got three people back. And that's kind of, you know, the genesis of the Labour Party was this kind of ongoing conversation with progressive liberals about kind of what a common programme might be, whether they could form a common party. And then, you know, it falls away with the First World War. But there's attempts in 1929. I mean, Lloyd George and the Liberals had a mini renaissance, and Keynes was kind of wrote the Liberals' kind of manifesto, and there was hope that the Labour Party, led by Ramsay MacDonald and Philip Snowden, would actually kind of adopt a Keynesian program that Lloyd George was running with. It didn't happen, and it just on and on and on. You have this kind of inability to get together, class, empire, the narcissism of small differences, a belief that actually socialism was actually taking on capital and the Liberals were too friendly to capital. All of that got in the way. Now, in 2024, I mean, class is no longer predetermines kind of your political allegiance in quite the same way. Empire is dead and buried. We live in broadly a service sector economy. And actually, it's obvious that actually progressive liberalism, with its emphasis on you have obligations to society as an individual and society has obligations to you, that kind of frame of thinking and an ethic of socialism, which is about fellowship, mutuality, having each other's backs, kind of like a Venn diagram, overlap and actually infusing them and integrating them. You have a really powerful kind of launch pad for progressive politics.
You talk about the good society and you have focused on this word, the we, W-E, rather than the I, the individual. Yet we speak at a time when quite a lot of the Thatcherite architecture is still in place. You root the no more mistakes from 79 onwards. What are the agencies that you envisage binding the good society?
That's a great question. I mean, I do devote some chapters to discussing, you know, what the foundations of a good society are. And I think there's kind of two or three strands. One is, and I think that, I mean, put me right, but I don't think it's too fanciful to argue that most Brits hold in mind simultaneously kind of notions of fellowship, and it's there in a trade union, it's there in most civic organisations. I ran at Oxford College for 9 years, and I worked a fellowship of kind of academics, having my back when my wife was dying, as well as being highly individualistic in the way they pursued their academic careers.
But that could become like David Cameron's Big Society, couldn't it?
Well, I always find the Big Society, I know that it was kind of, he just made it voluntarism, because I want to build on that kind of value system and then say what that you then have to put in place, kind of, you know, institutions that actually hold that value system and are supported by the public purse. So, you know, obviously, if you're talking about a floor, you've got to have a welfare system which is much less organized around means testing and much more organized around kind of as a citizen, you are paying into a fund which you can expect to look after you if things get tricky in your life. I also think that welfare should be organized a bit about giving individuals assets, particularly when they come to 18, 21 and 25, that permits them to kind of invest in themselves. There's all of that. There's health, healthcare. There's the way the criminal justice system operates. And there's housing. We've allowed housing to become not a kind of a roof over your head, but to become a kind of an asset. House prices are absurd, and they're the highest they've been for 140 years in London. They're 12 times average income. People are fleeing kind of zone one and zone two in London and some of our other central cities because the housing is too expensive. Schools are closing down. You know, our civilization is being menaced by kind of allowing housing to become an asset rather than a commodity material that serves our day-to-day needs. So, you know, the good society, you know, moves along a broad range of fronts, some voluntaristic, some funded by the public purse, some populated by institutions which we already have and others to be created, and all of that comes together.
Clearly, that implies a level of state intervention that we aren't used to, certainly since 1979. But what's exciting about your book is, you know, we hear the pre-election debate in the United Kingdom, tax cuts, Labour will stick to Tory spending plans, et cetera, et cetera. But where your book is really inspiring is that you suggest there are a whole range of mechanisms available to the next government, whoever it is. It does involve public investment, but it does then bring in more private sector investment. And it's how you do it.
Yep. Look, Britain is profoundly underinvested in economy and society. If you look at the numbers, our public and private investment together run kind of every year proportionately £100 billion less every year than an average of other industrialized countries. And cumulatively, that adds up. And it's all around us. It's MRI scanners in hospitals. It's schools that are crumbling. It's also kind of in local government going bust. I mean, there it is, you know. But it's also in the private sector. It's kind of the lack of capital at every kind of individual employee's hand means their productivity is growing more slowly than in other countries. And so you have stagnant productivity, you have stagnant wages, you have an intense cost of living crisis, kind of all have their roots in this kind of underinvestment. So you need to get public investment up to lead it. And I'm a strong advocate of borrowing for public investment and being very clear about the stock of assets on our national balance sheet, monitoring it, kind of wanting it to grow, set against the liabilities, which are, of course, our debts, the national debt. We only talk about liabilities, the national debt. You must have so many kind of interviews and discussions on the show, Steve, over the years in which we talk about debt to GDP ratios. I want to talk about the total balance sheet. And then once you've got that going, you can start to crowd in private investment off the back of it. But here's the point. You know, private investors will come in if they believe in the future, they believe there's an infrastructure, there are kind of support around them, that there is something to go for, and above all, that the savings and investment system will supply them with the credit and equity they need to do the business. So it's not just a question of public investment, it's a question of refashioning the savings and investment system. It's transformative, actually. And the good news is that there are people in the City of London who think the same same way. One of the things that when I wrote The State We're In kind of nearly over 25 years ago was that I was regarded as a kind of, fearsome socialist. Who's kind of this time round, I find there's lots of folk in the City of London who say, you're kind of right. We've got to start investing in our own backyard. The underinvestment is acute. The London stock market's in chronic trouble. We've got to turn this around. And so suddenly Labour have allies if it chooses to kind of go down this road as aggressively as I think it should.
So let's come, you mentioned Labour, let's come to the present and measure the degree to which your assessment of how we have got here and what needs to be done might be met. On the politics, clearly electoral reform, which might bring about that kind of coming together of the Labour and Liberal tradition, that's not going to happen, is it? The first past the post is in place and Labour aren't going to change that. So in a way, Labour would be the vehicle through which all this happens, not the sort of Lab Libery that you identified as potentially happening after the First World War in the late 20s. In the mid-90s.
On it goes. It has been, in the 1880s, Tory thinkers were saying, the 20th century will be our century if we can keep the opposition divided and retain first past the post.
Yeah. And look what happened. They were right.
They were right. And no wonder folk like Lord Salisbury, the Prime Minister, and other people have said that kind of thing, is so venerated by Tory historians and thinkers about Toryism. He was right. And the Liberal left handed it him on a plate. Ramsay MacDonald's kind of worst decision, I think, was of many, by the way, but trying to stay on the gold standard in 1929 wasn't clever. But there might have been a majority in the House of Commons at the end of the First World War to kind of end first past the post and introduce PR, but actually his opposition made it impossible. But anyway, that's another story.
Yeah.
Look, we are going to have a more sophisticated voting system. And I know there's a logic to first past the post, but the notion that in large parts of the country, it's not worth casting your vote because you know that the winner in the constituency in which you're living is preordained means that there's only worth casting your vote in, say, 100, 150 constituencies. The kind of disenfranchisement I think it generates is bad enough. Worse, though, is that actually the body of opinion in the country is not reflected in the composition of the House of Commons. And I think one of the reasons why we have such a kind of ferocious right-wing echo chamber and right-wing ecosystem at the moment is that they've been in power so long, they really believe they have a kind of line of sight and a kind of connection with the British electorate because they keep winning. That isn't true.
It wasn't true in the 80s.
I mean,
a big split there, Labour, SDP, and
I mean, it's mad. We live in a country with degraded public services, a degraded public square, and a kind of ailing capitalism, which isn't what the mass of people ever wanted. But it's been turned into that by the first past the post system, empowering a very ideological right to pursue a very particular and incorrect version of how capitalism works and what constitutes a good society. So, look, it needs to change. It could be, of course, that because the right has failed so spectacularly and is splintered at the moment, that actually it's going to splinter in the way that kind of the liberal left has splintered, and actually first past the post may work down to the progressive advantage. There is that horrible possibility. But even if that's the case, I think one must honestly put one hand on your heart and say that even if that were the case, if it was party advantage to have to retain first past the post in democratic terms and in public opinion terms, and in what kind of civilization we want to live in, it's still wrong.
I'm going to put the sort of gloomy side so you can cheer us up. So that's the politics.
I'll do my best.
On the kind of economic side, we've had these big national insurance cuts, which I know both you and I think a complete waste of money, but Labour felt compelled to support it. There will probably be an income tax cut before the election, more money gone. Labour will support it. They're coming in with tough fiscal rules. They won't rejoin the single market, probably not the customs union. And yet I know, and to some extent I share this, you are fairly optimistic that some of your agenda will be taken up. So given my kind of deliberately gloomy portrayal, why are you fairly hopeful?
Look, my grounds for kind of guarded optimism, and I'm not, I can see the truth in what your point is. First of all, you chronicle this well. I mean, the Labour Party nearly broke in the months leading up to the December 2019 general election under Jeremy Corbyn. It nearly split in a devastating defeat. And here we are talking in your studio in kind of April 2024. I mean, only 2 years ago, and the Tories were still kind of ahead in the polls. You know, you can forgive the Labour Party for being cautious, given, you know, that this recent opinion poll lead and prediction is going to form government is actually so kind of new. And Starmer himself, had he not won the Batley and Spen by-election by what are just over 300 votes, which is was going to resign. You know, they're still shell-shocked. Mm-hmm. So you've got to be slightly kind of, you know, forgiving. Secondly, I do think that the people at the top of the Labour Party, they're good people. And I think they lean into the kind of things that I'm saying, even if they feel they can't say it so openly or that electorally it's not easier to say, and I do kind of get that. I wish they were braver. There are some signs that some parts of gender are going to be picked up and run with. I mean, I think Rachel Reeves in her May's lecture did talk about borrowing for investment and organising the fiscal rules so that could happen. Yeah. So although she's dropped the 28 billion, she may get to the 28 billion green prosperity plan by a different and less kind of hazardous political route. So, you know, I do get all that. On Europe, I mean, I think that they're hoping that a defence and security pact will kind of be baggy enough to allow them to get alignment over things like data, security, food, energy, defence. And that's quite a lot of GDP, whether you'd have alignment with the EU, because you need it for defence purposes. And actually, I mean, the mass of working class, middle class voters in the UK kind of get that. And I think could be sold, actually. And there's even talk about, tremulously, about could they kind of approach having a customs union. I don't think that Red Wall voters give a damn about whether we're in a customs union or not. They do give a damn about attracting inward investment and jobs and rising living standards. Business and finance are much readier for this kind of conversation than they were 30 years ago. That's an important thing. And lastly, I mean, that woman in the street, you know, is kind of absolutely clear about the kind of disastrous state of public services and demand that they get better. Public opinion is kind of supporting a kind of move in this direction. I don't think an incumbent government has been as detested as the current Tory party is in modern political history. And the last thing is, which I think could become terribly important, is that actually the more bellicose and right-wing and populist the kind of rump Tory party becomes in coalition with or some accommodation with reform, the more obvious it will be the Labour leadership and actually Greens and Lib Dems as well, that actually you've got to make progressive government work. Otherwise, you know, you lose it to these populists and then it's real danger. So doing things along the lines I'm suggesting, you've got more chance of getting to Denmark, in inverted commas, than you have if you don't do that.
I think they're all good grounds for optimism, actually. We just don't know, do we? And I suspect they don't know either.
That's a trouble.
Turn out. And that is, in a way, the endless, compelling fascination with politics.
But
we dare to hope in that respect.
I dare to hope.
Yeah, but I mean, so do I. Could I ask you, I mean, you famously wrote The State We're In prior to the 97 election. And now here you are prior possibly to the return of another Labour government, possibly again with a big majority. Now, I remember early on Tony Blair, to a lesser extent Gordon Brown, picked up with the arguments in the state we're in. They then kind of dropped the terms, but they used to tell me, oh no, we're still following quite a lot of your agenda. I don't know whether you agree with them about that. Well, what do you, the parallels are obvious. Labour could win again and they could win quite big. Other than that, do you think we really are in an almost sort of unrecognizable world compared to when you published The State We're In? Here we are this time, no mistakes.
I do think that the evolution of thinking on the right and actually the impact of American conservatism and the American conservative revolution, libertarianism, Donald Trump, on the British conservatives has been quite profound. I also think that the immigration phenomena, which was not really salient when I wrote The State We're In, has become much more salient. Immigration phobia has become really a kind of one of the top five issues in British politics in a way it wasn't kind of 30 years ago. And that's kind of enabled a very aggressive, belligerent populism based on kind of hatred, actually. Mm. And again, I mean, I do think Britain is very tolerant, has been at least, a very tolerant and easygoing society. It's one of the delights of kind of living in this country. And some of the kind of attacks you get and the exchange you get on social media, and actually the way some policies on the right, I mean, you know, Suella Braverman, you know, Lee Anderson, I mean, you can list them, Nigel Farage himself, how this kind of poisonous drip, is actually changing our culture and emboldening people to say things that would have been unsayable 30 years ago. And that matters. And I think it makes it more important than ever that the Labour Party, supported by people who are sympathetic, even if they're not members of the party, govern well and actually help on the right the better angels to recover their party. I read Harold Macmillan's The Middle Way, wrote in 1938, became Prime Minister, of course, never had it so good, Supermac, in the late 50s, early 60s. And I was really amazed by The Middle Way. It's, in its way, it's radical. That's the state we're in.
Yeah.
It really took me back. And, you know, he didn't want the working class to suffer hunger. And he wanted to insist that minimum levels of nutrition were set across the country and local government should be empowered to make sure that every family had the right food every week and, you know, every day. And that kind of tradition does exist in Toryism and it needs to be recovered. If you want a stable democracy, you need people kind of sharing the same page, at least in core values, which is not what we've got. So I am kind of alarmed, you know, about that. On the other hand, as I said earlier, I think that there's a growing recognition amongst the better people in business and finance, and actually the better people in the trade union movement, that actually we need, if not exactly what I'm laying out in this book, but something along these lines is what's required. And I'm hopeful that we might get it.
And just finally, I mean, is there another cause for optimism that even with this 14-year period of Tory rule, it is interesting that these bunch of wild and unsuitable leaders, post-Cameron anyway, started recognising that the state had to have a bigger role than before that. Theresa May talked about the good the state can do.
Yes.
Johnson haphazardly raised taxes to pay for social. It's all been reversed. But there was almost as if forces were propelling them in the direction of a greater awareness of the need for an active state, which is...
Well, you have Nick Timothy's book, who was an advisor of Theresa May, it was in this territory. Red Toryism is in this territory. And I found elements of Mrs. May's election manifesto in 2017 really on the money, if you like. And now, there is that strand in Toryism.
We should make it easier for Labour then to put the case.
Yes, yeah. There's a possibility of a kind of a, you can see a kind of, you know, hazily, you know, the emergence of a new consensus. And actually, if you want to move a society in a democracy from a place like the one we're in to a kind of better place, there has to be some shared values and some minimal consensus about direction of travel. And you could see it's constructible. But to construct it, I think that the current wing of the Tory party that is so kind of is the playmaker in Tory in right-wing politics needs to kind of lose and lose again and for the better angels of that party to take it over. And then we might get somewhere.
Will Hutton, thank you very much indeed for coming in to discuss This Time, No Mistakes. So all of us, no mistakes. Well, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much.
Okay, that was Will Hutton and his book, This Time, No Mistakes. I'll put the link on the blurb for the website, but will, of course, be available in all the familiar places. And there's a lot to reflect on in our conversation together and look forward to hearing your thoughts about it as well. But you've only just heard it. So in the meantime, here are a few questions from recent weeks. And thank you all for sending in your questions. It's the usual email for our never-ending discussion, steverick14@icloud.com. steverick14@icloud.com. Okay, let's go to them now. John, last name withheld to try and avoid being purged from the Labour Party. I now think that is John Cernick. Quite often get points from him. And it's always John, no surname, in case I'll be purged. Anyway, he lives in Aberdeen, all those who want to purge him. Do you think the saying attributed to Enoch Powell, that all political careers end in failure, is accurate or mostly accurate? Also, did you attend or receive an invite to Nigel Farage's 60th birthday party? Can easily answer that one, John. And I think you can guess the answer. To the other point, it's a really interesting question. Of all the sort of cliches around politics, this is one that is repeated more often than most, you know, to greet the fall of the latest prime minister or whatever. And on one level, it is a clever observation because when you think of anyone, however mighty, the decline tends to be a signal of failure. But of course, it's much more layered than that. So you could argue that Thatcher's career ended in failure in the autumn of 1990 when she was the victim of a regicide after a crazy period of rule, actually. I'm going to do something more on that quite soon. Her last period of rule, I think in some ways makes Liz Truss seem calm and sensible. Also, what was Theresa May's thing? Strong and calm or whatever. Anyway, however, whilst that can be seen through the prism of failure, the fact that all Tory leaders and potential leaders worship at her altar to this very day, that Labour leaders feel obliged to pretend they are great admirers of hers. Maybe Tony Blair was sincere in that in some respects, but not the others. Shows that, you know, failure is multi-layered. The endings can mark failure. But quite a lot of stuff could have gone on before then. I'm talking in her terms about what she wanted to achieve, not whether we agree with what she wanted to achieve. Thank you, John. Stimulating question. A whole podcast could be done analysing that Powell quote. Alex Wolstenholme from Sheffield. Brilliant podcast. Oh, thank you, Alex. That's very kind of you. Do you believe that Reform's polling numbers entitle them to a proportionate share of the general election broadcast coverage, invitations to debates, etc., even though they have no MPs? For context, do you recall how the SDP were covered in 1983? It's interesting, of course, because the SDP had quite a few MPs in the 1983 election, because a lot of MPs had defected from Labour to the SDP. And I think the calculations on representation in broadcasting coverage during a campaign are based on a variety of things. It's certainly not just based on opinion poll ratings, although Nigel Farage, in whatever party he represents, seems to do pretty well in terms of prominence at the BBC. And has his own show on GB News. Though, interestingly, of course, if he stood at the election, even GB News wouldn't be allowed to use him as a presenter. Thank you, Alex. Dominica Jewell, by the way, thank you again to the legendary canon Paul Arbuthnot, who alerted me to the drama that was going to erupt over Jeffrey Donaldson, who has resigned as leader of the DUP at Westminster, having been a figure of pivotal significance in the build-up to the return of the Northern Ireland Assembly. Anyway, Dominica Jewell, who has often disagreed with Paul about events in Northern Ireland, I think agrees on, I mean, he Paul, without going into any detail, regards the whole development is highly significant and with all kinds of consequences for Northern Ireland. Now, I don't know whether he agrees or disagrees with this interpretation from Dominica Jewell. The opponents of returning to Stormont within the DUP, Sammy Wilson and all, have already taken the opportunity to distance themselves from Sir Geoffrey Donaldson by making it clear that no one among their group is willing to take on leadership responsibilities at present. Could this be because they want the current incumbents to own the mess with local elections looming and thus be in a position to regain their place within the party as strident opponents of the Northern Ireland Protocol and the Windsor Framework? Were this to be the case, the already fragile Northern Ireland Assembly may be even more unstable than at present. I, for one, will not miss this former protege of Enoch Powell, former member of the discredited UDR, a politician who opposed the Good Friday Agreement, etc. I predict, however, that his departure will mean testing times for politics in Northern Ireland. Well, I think Canon Paul agrees with you about that. He had noted a pragmatism in Geoffrey Donaldson, and he was proven right about that in relation to the Assembly being re-established. Yeah, there's so much that we in the Rock and Roll Politics Cooperative need to keep an eye on, and certainly the developments there are one of them. Linda Creek says, I was a first-time attendee and speaker at your recent King's Play show. Oh, great. Thank you, Linda. Where towards the end, you spoke about Keir Starmer and his need not just to share his backstory, but also to explain why he's in politics and what he wants to achieve. To me, his backstory shows he wants to right wrongs and do the right thing in a rational, measured way, whether that counts with the traditional Labour view or public opinion or not. Careful and painstaking doesn't really cover it strongly enough. He certainly is determined. I think his leadership of Labour accords very closely with how he acted as a lawyer. And unfortunately, many successful lawyers on the whole don't do the full showman act, but are more quietly competent. To me, this is what the country needs. Of course, he may now see the above as an area of vulnerability from right-wing press attacks and not an asset. Yeah, Linda was analysing his time as a lawyer when he did a lot of work for nothing for various causes and individuals. And he doesn't highlight it now because somehow to be, in inverted commas, a North London lawyer or a lawyer from Islington, even though he doesn't live in Islington, is seen as trouble in the current mad world we're in. But it is striking that, you know, he didn't go in for the money, for sure. He did a lot of hard work on tough testing cases, giving up time and the specialist skill for nothing. And that is a great quality. We'll just have to see, Linda. It's very hard in advance to work out precisely how someone will adapt to the demands of being a prime minister. And, you know, one of the emails says, oh, will it all get a bit boring if Keir Starmer wins? Not at all. It will be fascinating, not least after such a long period of one-party rule. So I share some of your optimism. I just don't know how his character will adapt. But no one knew really how Tony Blair would adapt or what Cameron would be like. That's why I tend to follow policy development as much as the backstory and, you know, oh, Keir loves football and stuff. Follow the policy trail. That's what helped me so much make sense of the Cameron and Osborne era when parts of the BBC and the Guardian and the Independent were saying, oh, he's this great reforming modernizer. Look at the policies, and they were Thatcherite, and in some ways an echo of Thatcher's and to the right of Thatcher's. But the tone appeared modern, in inverted commas. Anyway, thank you, Linda. Marion Sainsbury. We had an interesting car journey conversation over the Easter weekend. Ray, often, I assume Marion's partner, often talks about his huge admiration for the Attlee government. He attributes its success to strong ideological moral convictions, together with an iron determination to get things done. The question is, which, if any, members of the Blair cabinet or the Starmer shadow cabinet would merit a place in the Attlee government? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Robin Cook was my suggestion. Yeah, it was very hard, Marion, to transplant one set of people in one era
to an entirely different era. And so the 45 government was utterly unique and distinct. Many of them observed in the wartime coalition. A lot have been involved in the deep internal battles in the late 20s, early 30s that led to the split with Ramsay MacDonald and Labour struggling. It was Winston Churchill who brought life back into the Labour Party by inviting it into the coalition in 1940. Before that, they were trying to work out what the heck to do with the splintering of the Labour Party and Ramsay MacDonald forming the national government. But just to have a bit of fun and play a game, I think Gordon Brown would absolutely fit in that sort of government of figures with, in many cases, a deep sense of history and how the Labour Party had evolved, then relatively young, of course. And yeah, there have been quite a few others, actually, from there. Now, the shadow cabinet, we just don't know. The shadow cabinet is, in my view, as strong as the shadow cabinet in the build-up to 97. People say it's not, but that's because they look at the shadow cabinet as they became in government. And obviously some of them grew, not all, but some did. So I think it compares fine with the shadow cabinet of 1997. They have slightly less space to develop. It's one of the themes, if you subscribe to Patreon, that what emerges from the interviews I did with members of the shadow cabinet in the build-up to 97, they had a bit of space to challenge and offer slightly different views than the leadership for all the talk of control freakery. And in Claire Short's case, a huge difference of view. And they all kept their jobs. But anyway, it's an interesting game. But it was such a different era. But they were big figures. And you do wonder, with, say, the drop of the £28 billion, a relatively modest proposal to address climate change and to trigger economic growth, announced a few months ago by Keir Starmer, Rachel Reeves and co., whether things like the NHS, when opposed by the Tories and some Tory newspapers, would have ever got off the ground. But we're playing a sort of game here because the eras are so different. Venetia Kaine, oh yeah, on floating voters. Who are the floating voters? This is direct from the doorstep. I know many of you canvass as well. But anyway, this is Venetia's experience from the doorsteps. It seems to me that floating voters are swayed by mainly two things: perceived likability of leaders and past performance where relevant. Most commonly heard recently, we've got to get this lot out. So my surmise would be that ideas are only relevant to potential donors, and perhaps it was in effect to them that Rachel Reeves was speaking. Well, I don't know about that. Donors as in party donors, Venetia, I think ideas can drive a lot more than that. Anyway, she goes on to say, I think there will be a huge protest vote against the Tories in the election. Those floating voters will go a third to Reform, third to the Lib Dems, and a third won't vote. And anything left over will go to Labour. But first past the post will then let Labour in with at least 100 majority, which, I define that as a landslide. 100 majority is not that big in such a context. Interesting. Well, there we are. Some thoughts there from the doorstep. Andy White. Yeah, we were a question last week asked to put in order the prime ministers since 2010. Andy White suggests, rather than who was the worst PM, perhaps we should be asking when was the worst PM. When did the Tory party lose its way, lose its grip? For me, it was during the time of Theresa May. Anyway, Andy says, you got me thinking on a drizzly, chilly and generally not very inspiring Maundy Thursday. Yeah, well, the whole Easter was a washout, wasn't it? I think it goes much further back, Andy. I think you can go back to the mid-1990s, actually. You know, John Major was, between 90 and 92, was moving it towards, or trying to, a kind of one-nation Toryism. but it wasn't strong enough to succeed. And yet they got rid of Thatcher. So were they, in their reaction to John Major, wanting more of her, even though they had removed her? There was a period of identity crisis, never fully resolved. And I think even by 2010, there was this odd claim to be modernizers and centrists, which, say, fooled a lot of the media. But the policy trail from 2010 was pretty right-wing, to the right of Margaret Thatcher in some respects. And so I think it's been a long time coming. And while I agree with your counterintuitive choice about Theresa May or the timing of that period being not quite as dutiful as it is now seen because of the chaos that followed with Johnson and Truss, I think the seeds of the crisis in the Tory party go very deep. Thank you, Andy. Thomas Spee, loving the podcast. Oh, thank you, Thomas. And he's going to come to a live show soon. Jolly good. See you there. I've been thinking in relation to your comments on how the SDP were so much more impactful than Reform. They were in some ways, Thomas, but in others, Reform too are playing a big part in the build-up to this election. But anyway, Thomas wonders about the independent group, Change UK, launched back in 2019. What do you think their relative failure said both of the strength of the Lib Dems and our two-party system, as well as about how the landscape had shifted since the early 80s? The relative failure of the Change UK project was down to a lack of deep, coherent thinking. You can see it was doomed from the beginning when some of the Tories who joined Change UK at their launch praised the austerity policies of David Cameron and George Osborne, which had been passionately opposed by the Labour people of Change UK. So when there was that basic disagreement on day one, and Change to what? They were for Remain, obviously, but that was a status quo position. It wasn't a Change position. So changing where Owen, Jenkins, Williams, Rogers, the Gang of Four, the SDP Gang of Four, thought long and hard about what they were for. And as I say, managed to get a load of MPs to defect. So they had a big parliamentary presence from the beginning. And won some by-elections. So that's why they've made more impact than Reform. But Reform, of course, is tormenting Sunak at the moment and forcing him further to the right when he's getting advice about the dangers of that and making his leadership even more incoherent. So they are playing a part. It's just not as substantial a one. And Change UK is a real, you know, the great media excitement. It was right up the street of non-Tory commentators in newspapers and the BBC. So they had quite a few things going for them, but they didn't have coherence and depth and were therefore doomed. And boy, did that one fall apart very quickly. Anyway, look, you must have done so much in the time of this podcast, and we've crammed a lot in. So I'll stop there. Sorry if I didn't get to your question. But yeah, we all need to get together very soon. Please leave a review if you can, because apparently that kind of changes everything in the whole world, but only if you like it. And yeah, let's get together very soon to make sense of it all. Thank you. Bye.